It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at the next steps for Wisconsin's same-sex marriage case in light of the Seventh Circuit Court's ruling against the state's ban yesterday.
First, a look at how music education impacts our brains and the way we learn. That's the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestra performing Grieg's Piano Concerto in A Minor. Deerfield's Charlie Collar on piano.
Our next guest has been studying music and kids and brains and has found amazing benefits for things like learning, literacy, and more for youth who get serious musical training. And new findings out this week, a two-year study shows improvements in certain kinds of cognitive ability for kids who participate in long-term community music programs.
Nina Kraus joins us now. She's professor and principal investigator at the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University. Nina, great to have you with us.
Well, good to be here.
In your research out this week, you looked at a community music program for at-risk youth, and what did you find?
Well, let me put the work in some context. So, in our lab, so I'm a biologist, and we study the biology of learning, of auditory learning, and the ways in which certain forms of enrichment, like music education, speaking another language, and other forms of deprivation, such as living in poverty, growing up with a hearing loss or a learning disability, may impact auditory learning. And so we have actually two neuroeducational projects, one involving Chicago Public Schools and the other involving the Harmony Project out in L.A. Both of these are programs in which children receive music education in existing and successful programs. And they came to me because they were noticing, the founders of these programs were noticing that the children who studied music were succeeding and doing better across the board in other aspects of their schooling. And they wanted to know what was going on in their brains. And, you know, being a biologist and interested in the biology of learning, and really our work is rooted in how what we can find in the laboratory can be applied in real-world situations, I was anxious to take a look at this. And so to answer your question about this most recent study, this was published in Journal of Neuroscience this week, where we were following children in the Harmony Project, and these children were randomly assigned to either, they were taken from the Harmony Project waiting list. Harmony Project has many more kids who want to be in the music program than they can support, and some of the kids were able to begin the music training right away, and another group had to defer, but they were still promised a spot later on. And we measured the brain's responses to sound in these children, both before they began music, 1 year afterwards, and then 2 years after that. I can tell you a little bit about how we measure these responses to sound. Of course, as I'm talking to you now, mm-hmm. the nerves in your brain that respond to sound are giving off electricity, and we can capture these electrical events with scalp electrodes. Now, the particular biologic approach that we use is very sensitive to how it is that the nervous system processes the fundamental ingredients of sound. So for both speech and music, sound consists of pitch, timing, and timbre. So these elements of pitch, timing, and timbre that you can see, and I'm sure you in radio see these signals all the time. You can see in these elements of pitch, timing, and timbre in the sound wave. But we want to know, how does the brain represent these elements of sound?
And we'll get into that in just a moment. A reminder that we're talking to Nina Krause with the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University about the impact of music education on how we learn, how kids learn in particular. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How has music education helped you or your kids? Does it help you? Do you think it helped with your education and with your life in other ways? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. So, Nina, you were talking about how our brains read pitch and timbre and that sort of thing. So how is it that music education helps our brains with that kind of auditory stimulus and then in turn affects reading and the other ways we learn?
Well, it turns out that there is a lot of overlap between speech and music in both. You know, these are both signals that are handled through sound. They both consist of pitch, timing, and timbre, and they are processed through overlapping circuitry in the nervous system. So that if you strengthen your sound to meaning connections through playing a musical instrument, so you're listening to the elements of sound and you are imparting meaning both by how you're learning to play the instrument, how you're thinking about the sound, that is strengthening pathways that are also important for processing speech. So you would like to have a nervous system that, because of its practice in doing very complex sound to meaning processing through music, becomes a machine, if you will, that then processes any sound automatically with greater precision and fluidity.
Do we know how much music training kids need to see the payoffs? I mean, if a kid goes to piano lessons once a week, is that going to do the trick?
Well, there's no specific dosage effect. but I can tell you, and this is something that we saw in this study as well, is that after 1 year, we did not see these fundamental brain changes in how the brain automatically responded to speech sounds. But we saw these after 2 years. So, and this is important because, it takes the nervous system some time to change in fundamental ways. On the one hand, it's very important to have a nervous system that is flexible and that changes based on how we learn. On the other hand, you can't have a nervous system that's changing every second. And so it's really through persistent and repetitive connections that are made that these fundamental ways in which the brain automatically processes speech sounds become shaped.
It's amazing. So after this couple of years of music training, there are measurable differences, I guess, in the way our brains light up or our nervous system reacts to different stimuli?
Yeah.
Interesting. So, and then how is it when we start measuring performance in the classroom? I know a lot of your other research has gone in that direction as well.
Well, so there has been a lot of research linking these particular brain measures that we were able to measure in the Harmony Project kids with language skills, especially such as reading and hearing speech in a noisy place like a classroom or a playground. What was especially interesting to me about the Harmony Project children is that we know that these children are inordinately successful by real-world metrics. The children in the Harmony Project, the founder, Margaret Martin, won a presidential award for the success that this program has had in keeping kids in school, out of jail, and graduating and going on to get good jobs and college. It's really the part of the inherent interest in studying these children was trying to get at the heart of what might be happening in their nervous systems that could account for some of these successes.
We're talking to Nina Kraus from Northwestern University's Auditory Neuroscience Lab. She's sharing research on the ways musical training can adjust kids' brains, maybe adults too, we'll get into that, and our nervous systems, and help with learning, boost our learning systems in a way.
And you can join our conversation if you felt these benefits in your life or have you seen it in your own children. If you're a music teacher, how do you see things like band and choir and music lessons helping kids in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Music education is good for our brains and it helps kids learn. Those are some of the findings from our guest. Nina Kraus stays with us. She researches music, learning, and the brain at Northwestern University.
And you can join the conversation. How has music affected your life, your kids? What's the value of music education? And would you like to see more of it in our schools and communities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
And we go to our callers now. Jennifer is first in Monticello. Hi there, Jennifer.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to say I'm a teacher myself. And when I was in fifth grade, I learned a song called 50 Nifty United States.
Mm-hmm, I know that.
And I don't want to sing it because I'm not a music teacher. But I have taught that to my first graders every year. And then they point out the states on the map. And they all know them by the end of the year. And I am old enough that I've had some students come back and they say, you know, I still remember that. And that's how I remember where the states are.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of songs about the solar system. I try to incorporate music as much as I can into my just general education class that I, you know, that I teach. And it's just, it's one way that I learned. And it's even, you know, now when I have state graduate classes, I still make up songs to remember things.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks for bringing that song to mind again, 50 Nifty United States. But there is something about music that makes it easier to remember things. At least it seems that way. Is that part of this, Nina?
Yeah. So music really has a privileged role to memory. And I mean, even before things were written down, history was transmitted through bards and song. We, you know, think about how you strengthen your memory by some of the musical tasks you might be asked to do. So, for example, for just tuning your instrument, you need to remember the note and then tune your instrument. If you have a musical idea and I'm going to improvise on it, I need to remember what your idea was if I'm going to improvise on it. And if I'm trying to play, say, a passage that another musician has played, I have to hold that in my mind in order to play it. So your auditory working memory, especially, is really used very much with music, and we use our auditory working memory just right now as you're listening to me on the radio. You need to remember what I just said a few minutes ago if you're going to make sense of what I'm saying right now. Working memory, of course, is important as we read. We have to remember what we just read to make sense of what we're reading in the moment.
Interesting. Well, Nina, we've been focusing on kids so far, but say there's an adult who's not done the music thing. They haven't taken the lessons. Is there a benefit for their brain, for their learning, for their memory to get out and get started, even if they're not kids?
Yeah. So what we know, biologically speaking, is that the nervous system continues to change and continues to have the capacity to learn until we die. And some work that one asks, what about music education that you have had earlier in life? Might that have an impact when you are older? And what we've been able to determine is that people who have had musical experience early in life, you know, when I talk about this, I often will ask an audience, how many of you had music lessons as children and how many of you are playing music now? And of course, many had some years of music lessons and few are continuing to play music. But it would appear that the influence that early music making has on, again, being able to neurally process speech sounds. You know, as we get older, one of the most common complaints is difficulty hearing in noisy restaurants, for example. And people with musical training have nervous systems that, again, seem to be able to pull out relevant signals of sound, speech sounds, better than people who had not had that in their background.
And we're going to go to another caller here. Carolyn joins us in Appleton. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a comment. I think thank you so much to your guests, and I'm so excited that there's some hard data on the benefits of music in children's lives, but also in adults' lives. I'm a musician. I've been playing music since the fourth grade, and I know how much it's impacted my life and my relationships with people. But I think that's a hard thing to convince our elected officials of, and I think that we take music education in public schools for granted. And I can see that because I've spent the last couple summers volunteering to teach music in Haiti, which is a very impoverished country, and they don't incorporate music education into their school. It's a very special thing. And what I see there are these community music schools popping up all over the country because people in these communities are seeing the value of music education for youth in Haiti, the way that it teaches them to communicate, to listen. Also, it's a social equalizer. Someone who's very well off can sit down and play next to someone who's very poor, and you're both playing the same music. And I think that the social and the learning values of that are seen elsewhere, but I wish more people saw that here in the United States, and I hope that people take advantage of the opportunities that they have to learn music.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Carolyn. Really, really fascinating story about what you've seen with music in Haiti. What do you think about some of those points, Nina?
Well, music, you know, as I said at the very beginning, I study learning. I study the biology of learning. And it would appear that music is a really wonderful model for learning because in order, you know, we learn through many, many different ways, but in order for learning to occur in the brain, we need to be engaging our senses. You know, I say we are sensory, cognitive, and reward systems. So what do I mean by that? Our senses is the information we get through our eyes and ears. Cognitive is how we remember and pay attention to things, how we think about things. And reward is how we feel about them. And we know that learning happens when these three aspects of nervous system function are brought into play. And so music very much engages the sensory, cognitive, and reward circuitry in the nervous system, and as such, seems to be an especially powerful model for learning, especially learning through sound.
Nina, very briefly before we're out of time, do you think there's enough research there to say, hey, money spent on music education is money well spent?
Well, I can provide the data, and I think it speaks for itself.
All right, Nina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That's Nina Kraus. She's professor and principal investigator at the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University. You and I have both done music, Veronica. I feel like, I don't know, some of it probably pays off, at least in being a radio host, the kind of focus that she was talking about in the auditory learning.
Right. Every time we do these shows, I want to go home and play my piano. I think you just need to bring your saxophone in one day and I'll do some free jazz over it. And we'll just, you know, make some music on the radio.
Turn the show into perform. Maybe let's do that on the midnight shift sometime.
Okay, maybe we should try it out first. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestra takes us into the news here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get some great ideas for lunchbox treats as the kids head back to school.
First, a federal appeals court ruling came down yesterday with a three-judge panel deciding unanimously that the same-sex marriage bans in Wisconsin and Indiana are unconstitutional.
The ruling came 9 days after the judges heard oral arguments in the case, during which Judge Richard Posner put very challenging questions to the attorneys from Wisconsin and Indiana defending the ban.
Yesterday's ruling also came a day after a federal judge in New Orleans ruled in favor of maintaining Louisiana's ban on same-sex marriage. Since the Supreme Court ruled on the matter last year, every federal judge to hear a state case had ruled against same-sex marriage bans.
As it stands, same-sex marriages have not resumed here in Wisconsin, and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen's office has said he will appeal the decision to the Supreme Court.
It remains to be seen if the Supreme Court will take this case or another case that could reach the court ahead of Wisconsin's. Here with us now to talk about the future of Wisconsin's same-sex marriage law is Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back.
Good afternoon. How are you, folks?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Good, good. So it's been quite an exciting time for gay marriage across the federal courts this last week.
Exactly. A lot of action, and as we talked about, some of it contradictory, but we're going to start with Wisconsin. A 40-page decision yesterday and a unanimous ruling against the ban. What do you make of that ruling?
Well, you know, Judge Posner has always been known for having incisive critiques. He is a Reagan appointee and is considered to be conservative. At one time, he and Scalia were actually considered to be kind of ideological equals in some ways. But Posner has always sort of parted company and stayed focused on different issues. There's been a little bit of a challenge between the two of them. You've seen some kind of dickering between Posner and Scalia. And so that's why his decision is really quite striking. And it was not such a surprise. No one is surprised by it because his oral arguments 9 days ago, I mean, some people said he was bordering on mocking the state's attorney generals with questions. So it's not that much of a surprise that he came down the way he did.
And as we said, there was a 40-page decision there. Can you hit some of the highlights for us on what it contained?
I think part of what Posner is trying to do is to systematically go through, and while he can't address all of those cases out there, remember, we've had 21 opinions now out of federal courts with a wide variety of different arguments, and it seems pretty clear what Posner was trying to do, and he's known for his legal writing, is to try to crystallize those arguments and pretty much tear them apart. And that's part of the reason why you see it being both so long and also why he goes into great detail to address the different arguments between Indiana and Wisconsin. But much of it boils down to these critical arguments. What interest can the state show to justify why they want to ban same-sex marriage? And that typically falls into protecting traditional marriage. Traditional marriage will be undervalued. There's this concern about children and the need for children to remain with biological parents. Indeed, in Judge Martin Feldman's ruling, who was out of Louisiana, and Feldman stands as the lone judge in all of these cases to uphold same-sex marriage bans, you know, Feldman goes into great detail about the issue regarding children and upbringing and the well-being of children in heterosexual versus homosexual families, and as a justification for the state for why it has an interest in protecting heterosexual marriage. And so Posner systematically went through and said, you know, the reason why it's a harm to children is because you don't acknowledge gay marriage. And if you would acknowledge, you say on the one hand that that marriage is important for protecting children, and yet on the other hand, you don't allow gay couples who have children that same ability to protect their children by being in a married and committed relationship, your argument's not making any sense. And then going into greater detail, Posner did, about, well, then, you know, what is the state of marriage? And if we look at the state of children inside and outside of wedlock and the numbers that Wisconsin and Indiana, the attorney generals, are putting forward as justification for why they want to take the position they do, just doesn't hold up when you look at the numbers and the social science evidence. And so that's what Posner was doing.
Any chance that the length of this decision and the forcefulness of it could be seen as baiting the Supreme Court to pick it up?
Absolutely. And not only that, here's the key thing. That decision came down 9 days after the oral arguments. Compare that to, on average, an appeals case will take anywhere from 6 months to a year. I believe Feldman took almost a year in his opinion. The fact that the Seventh Circuit moved so quickly, many people are looking at that and going, Posner, are you trying to, like, sort of yank the chain of the Supreme Court and let them know, hey, I'm out here? And don't forget that there are 32 states that have asked the Supreme Court to settle gay marriage. Some of those states are pro-gay marriage. Some have prohibitions on gay marriage. But 32 of the states have said, we want you to look at three cases out of Virginia, Utah, and Oklahoma and overturn those bans. And by the decision out of the Seventh Circuit happening so quick, being so detailed, it most certainly is going to be sitting there waiting to be included into those cases that I would say almost certainly the Supreme Court is now going to have to consolidate and decide.
Does it work that way? Does the Supreme Court look at this and read the message, you know, pick up one of these guys and react?
Well, you know, now we're all reading tea leaves on how the Supreme Court is going to act. But certainly it has created additional pressure on resolving this issue once and for all. And most of the pressure is going to be placed on Justice Kennedy. In fact, if you read Judge Feldman out of Louisiana's case closely, he almost seems to be trying to play a little bit to Kennedy and some of the arguments that Kennedy made in the previous Windsor decision, to kind of say, look, I know that the court has kind of stayed out of the gay marriage, saying it's just not the federal government's place to do it, but when you decide the state, can the states decide it, I want you to remember this, Justice Kennedy. So it's not clear how the court will see it, but it is clear there's going to continue to be pressure and more cases coming forward. This isn't stopping. This is continuing to move forward.
What makes a case more or less likely to be picked up, and where do you see Wisconsin in that list?
Well, one of the key things, the Wisconsin case is quite interesting because everybody watches Posner, but there's this long been this theory about how we look at the court, that the court looks to do what we call error correction, that if they see bad decisions out there, it's their job to step in and reverse those decisions. In this particular case, though, it's a little different because you have the overwhelming weight of the federal court evidence, you know, federal court decision-making indicating that they do not support same-sex, you know, marriage bans. And so, you know, the question is, can they make enough of a compelling case that puts enough pressure on the Supreme Court that they're going to go ahead and have to resolve this tough issue?
Now, we talked a little bit at the beginning about a New Orleans federal judge upholding Louisiana's same-sex marriage ban. So how does that piece of the puzzle factor in?
Well, part of it is that it comes down in terms of the arguments that get made. But when you look across the different circuits in the district courts, I mean, it's pretty clear that Judge Feldman is in a very, you know, quiet minority out there. Now, it has been the case that if you look at the appellate courts, there are dissents. A number of them are 2-1 dissents. So we don't want to paint a picture that somehow the federal courts are all unified and that, you know, gay marriage is going to happen, because it's about the arguments that are within the case. And it looks like what Feldman is trying to do is to say, I'm trying to crystallize the arguments that the state is putting forward regarding it's the interest that it has in protecting traditional marriage. And so to that extent, it's going to be in the same company as some of those other dissenting opinions that they've had at the Circuit Court of Appeal level.
What do you see as the options on Wisconsin's law going forward now that this ruling has come down?
Well, I think it's just going to continue to you make the decision that you're going to go ahead and press the case. You're going to push forward, and you're either going to make a decision that you're going to appeal it, or you're going to say, hey, you know what, this is costing us a lot of money and a lot of political capital, and we're not interested in doing that. So it's going to be incumbent upon the attorney generals in this case to sit down and have a serious conversation about how they want to expend their resources on litigation. One of the reasons why the 32 states have asked the Supreme Court to settle the gay marriage issue is because a great deal of time, energy, effort, resources on the part of state governments, either defending bans or striking down, you know, or allowing gay marriage, it's just a lot of time and energy is being spent on this. And the result is that we have these series of patchwork rulings out there. I would say the best bet, and it's hard to know where this is going, but one thing that most commentators are talking about is that Kennedy will come down on the side of, if you want to have gay marriage, then states can have it, and if they want to ban it, they want to ban it. They can ban it, that it's something that's within the state's jurisdiction. And that's one of the outcomes. When you look at the Windsor case, they walked a fine line there with just saying that the federal government can't regulate it, but not resolving the issue of what the states could do. I think it is vitally important to look at the part of Posner's decision that talks about Loving versus Virginia and interracial marriage. And he makes a strong case, and it's clear he's trying to align the case here with the Loving decision back in 1967, that this is no different from the bans on interracial marriage. And it just as those fell, it's time for these to fall.
Well, a lot of eyes on this one. We're going to keep watching it. Kimmy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Keep up the great work, folks.
All right. Thanks a lot. We've been speaking with Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, about the future of Wisconsin's same-sex marriage case. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For parents across the nation, this is the week they either dreaded or couldn't wait for. It's back to school week.
It's also the time we send our kids out into the great unknown, the world of school lunches. That's got lots of parents packing their own lunch boxes for the kids. But how do you make sure you're packing a healthy lunch and one that your kid will actually eat?
It's the topic of today's Food Friday. Here to give us some ideas is Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. Anna, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, after sending your kids off to school this week, how are you feeling?
Oh, we're feeling good. The kids will be home on the bus pretty soon, hungry and ready for a snack and a nice relaxing weekend.
And so, you know, you're someone who thinks a lot about food. What are you thinking as you put together your child's lunchbox?
You know, I think of a couple things. One, I try to keep in mind how little time they have to eat. So I try to keep things simple and quick for them. Also, I keep in mind allergies. There's a lot of kids where you can't bring peanuts or tree nuts to school. And I also want to make sure that it's something that they're going to eat and that is going to give them some fuel for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, sometimes with school lunches with my kids, I feel like what happens at school stays at school. You don't know if the food got eaten or traded or creatively discarded. How do you try to make sure the stuff you're packing is something that they're actually going to eat?
You know, we just have a really open dialogue, and at the beginning of each week or on the weekend, we talk about what they'd like to have in their lunches that week, what things they liked, what things they didn't like, and I really try to have them involved. They either will help me shop, or sometimes they actually will help me prepare the lunch. They can make their own sandwiches, they can slice up cheese, but I just make sure they have a hand in it so that they feel like they are stakeholders and, you know, chose what they got in their lunchbox that day.
That seems so obvious, but I bet a lot of us don't do it. My family doesn't always do that. And they're not just asking for Twinkies and Oreos?
No, but they haven't had a lot of those things, so on purpose, so... no, they really, they ask for, and I'll be specific, I'll say, what kind of fruits or vegetables do you want today?
Mm.
So sandwiches are an old standby, except for my kids, who really, for some reason, never got into sandwiches. I don't quite get that. So what are some good alternatives for that lunchbox entree?
Yeah, you know, you can do kind of a switch on the old sandwich. You know, you could do a wrap, you could do, they have those cute little mini pita pockets. You could put something on an English muffin, or you can go totally different. A lot of times we'll do kind of a charcuterie platter, and we'll have some, you know, sliced dry salami and some dates and some carrots and hummus and kind of just a bunch of little things put together that they can graze on and have a variety to choose from.
But how do you fit a platter in the lunchbox?
Well, I kind of have some creative little Tupperwares that have nice little sections. So
okay.
I have more tiny Tupperwares than larger ones.
What has been a greatest hit so far?
You know, they're pretty basic. They really like the dried fruit. They like, we do some homemade trail mix. They like muffins. They also like some leftover dinner favorites. We have a thermos for each of them. And if we do some homemade mac and cheese or pizza or soup, they definitely like to take that the next day as well.
And speaking of muffins, in the piece you wrote, you wanted to get something a little special. So in advance, you made some muffins. Why are you sending the kids to school with muffins this week?
You know, muffins is like the best all-purpose food. You can, if you put the right things into them, I feel good about giving them to kids for breakfast, for a snack, or even a dessert. So, you know, if you add in a little bit of whole grain flour, you can add in, you know, some protein things and some dried fruit, but you can also add in some nice things like a little bit of dark chocolate to make it seem special.
Now, you've got a recipe for chocolate cherry muffins that your kids like. Can you walk us through that one? What's in it?
Sure. It's a pretty basic muffin recipe. The highlights are, you can do half regular all-purpose flour, half whole wheat for a little added whole grain. We use dried cherries, or this time of year, fresh cherries are really wonderful too, and a little bit of dark chocolate.
Mm. That's pretty simple. We've got a recipe, or you've got a recipe, I should say, in your Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece. We put a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. The fresh cherries, they bake up the same as the dried cherries, more or less?
Yeah, they do. They'll have a little bit more color. The color will bleed a little bit, but they're still very delicious.
I kind of like that in muffins when the berry color bleeds into the other stuff, like blueberries.
Stop, you two. You're making me crave muffins.
Okay, I got to go.
We've got two more hours of show.
To the muffin store.
All right, well, let's move on to peanut butter and jelly. You were talking about allergies with tree nuts and peanuts, and that's pretty common these days. So are there alternatives? Because that's long been a staple, but if you can't go that direction, what can you do?
Yeah, it's very common. In some schools these days won't even let you bring them to school, either the peanut butter or the tree nuts. And my kids are actually allergic to tree nuts. They're okay with peanuts, but not the alternative. So we use a lot of seeds and seed butters. So you can find sunflower seed butter quite readily at most grocery stores these days. And basically any recipe that calls for any kind of nut, if you substitute in sunflower seeds, raw pumpkin seeds, or even a mix of sesame seeds and chia seeds, which are smaller but still add some protein, you can get that same crunch and that same nutrition level.
You know, a big problem I have with packing school lunches sometimes is I'm doing it in a hurry, maybe after dinner. I haven't planned ahead. What are the keys to make sure you have on hand from the grocery store or to prepare maybe the weekend before so that you're not scrambling at the last second?
You know, if you're going to kind of put some stuff together from scratch, you have to put the time in at some point. So it's nice to do it ahead and do it early. So on the weekends, we'll usually pick one kind of more treat snacky thing, either a big batch of granola, a big batch of muffins, or a batch of cookies that have some whole wheat and some oatmeal in there for a little bit more nourishment. And we'll make at least a big batch of that on the weekend, which will serve as either after-school snacks or as kind of a dessert in the lunch all week. Cutting up things like carrots are really nice to have on hand, and cauliflower. A lot of kids really do like raw, crunchy vegetables, especially if you pair them with a nice dip like a hummus or a ranch dressing. Mm. So doing some of that prep time ahead of time, and also easy things like boiling up eggs. A hard-boiled egg makes a great very easy lunch.
Now, it sounds like the two of you do a lot of your lunch prepping the night before. Is that, I don't know, I always thought the lunch would get sort of, you know, when things have been sitting in the freezer and they kind of harden or the refrigerator. Is there an ideal time to prepare the food? Is the night before better or is the morning of best?
You know, I do better if I do it the night before just because I have more time to put some thought into it. But you're right, you do have to think about it. If you're making, you know, a lot of sandwiches may not be so great the night before. So one thing you could do is if you were doing something like tuna or egg salad, you could at least have the filling ready and then put it on the bread the morning of. Other things, if, you know, I don't know how many kids actually take salad to lunch, but definitely keep your dressing separate, or this is maybe for more adult lunches, or do a kale salad, which actually improves over time with dressing on it.
Okay, so let's get to the end of the school day. The kids have expended calories learning wonderful things and at recess and whatnot. They're hungry again when they get home. What's on hand for the after-school snack?
You know, it's such a balancing act because if you don't give them anything, then by 4:30 they're in the kitchen just harassing you to the point where you're ready just to throw graham crackers at them, and then you have no chance of getting them to eat dinner. But they're also hungry and their blood sugar's low and they've, you know, been doing a job all day. So I like to have something small with a little bit of protein or fat in it to keep them sustained until, you know, 5 or 5:30 when we have dinner, but not have them so filled up that they won't eat dinner, because hungry kids do a lot better at dinner about trying new things and eating the healthy things they should. So we'll either do something really basic like a whole piece of fruit, or we'll kind of go back onto that big batch thing I made, either a little bit of granola and yogurt or a granola bar, something just with a little bit of sweetness to lift their blood sugar, but also some protein and fat just to keep them steady until the dinner hour.
Some lessons we can apply to the public radio world there too. Anna, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance food writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. We've got a link to her article with that muffin recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.